This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So, good afternoon, everyone. And we are coming to the end of Shantideva's Guide to the Way of the Bodhisattva, Chapter 9, The Perfection of Wisdom. I'm going to read the first verse. Buddha taught all the method practices explained above to enable us to complete the training in the wisdom realizing emptiness. Therefore, those who wish to liberate themselves and others from suffering should strive to develop this wisdom. So it's the Bodhisattva way in a nutshell. He's given us all the verses before with all the various ways that we even didn't cover all, but there are many, many ways, methods, practices in Shantideva's guide. In this chapter, many people consider the, people that I've read and people that I've talked to about this chapter consider it, you know, the ultimate. It's written in a different form. It's kind of a prose poem, if you will, or a blend of actually quatrains and prose. And there's quite a long dialogue between Shantideva and another person and persons from different schools of Buddhism. So it's interesting if you're in that frame of mind to read that. If you enjoy that sort of thing, it's really quite profound, I think. And I don't pretend to understand it all, and I'm not a scholar. Like many people are who've really dived into Shantideva from that perspective of history and scholarship. But it's still the words somehow come across. So, but what Shantideva, as I understand, is saying is that all of this comes down to emptiness. So what does that mean for my understanding? It's everything is contingent and on everything else. And we've discussed that somewhat in these days. We've picked up some verses that bring this out more than others. So all existence is contingent on everything else, on every level. And even beyond that, emptiness is not emptiness. It's that kind of contingency. It's that paradox, that paradoxical, this world we live in, which we often feel and know in ourselves is paradoxical. How can this be? Yet it is, it truly is. So in a way, that emptiness is not emptiness because emptiness is a word. It's part of the structure of our minds, which we're endowed with that structure. Or maybe you could say we're blessed and cursed with that structure to use language to make concepts and to try to understand the world. So in a way, we use language and try to understand the world so that we can live and thrive in the relative world. But what's the emptiness that Shantideva says will lead to our fulfilling our vows and exchanging self for other? It's really seeing deeply into that paradox somehow. And it doesn't have to come from words. In fact, there are lots of Zen stories, which are words, but there are lots of stories about people who come to this understanding of emptiness and realization of the interplay between the relative and ultimate realities by, for example, in One Bright Pearl in Dogen, stubbing their toes. So Zen is full of these stories where you don't have to be doing study, and not necessarily words. Often, the Zen master just hits somebody, or somebody stubs their toe, falls on their face, a tree limb falls on them, and they get it. But they have been working with it up until then. They don't just get it like walking along the street and a tree branch falls on them. Although there are even kind of stories like that. Wei Ning famously just was a little kid who, very young man, who just trying to sell kindling wood in a marketplace, and heard one word of the Diamond Sutra, and that woke him up. So who knows what mysteries and miracles there are in the world, really, when we allow those to be possible. So everything existing within everything else, depending on everything else. And these realities, the ultimate and conventional, they coexist like we coexist with everything. We need the conventional reality in order to act on our bodhicitta. We need that to help to see and to help the beings, including ourselves, who are suffering. So these are conventional beings living in this conventional world. So a little background on where this idea, or perhaps just a little germ of where this idea started, because it's a particularly Mahayana and a Zen idea. So it does all come from the mind. It is about words and about understanding this paradox. Shantideva was highly influenced by the middle way school, the Madhyamika, and especially by Nagarjuna from a few centuries earlier, five or six centuries earlier, who was a Buddhist monk and scholar. And he's considered to have written the ultimate text on this, which he called the Madhyamaka, the middle way. Which is also a dialectic, but he's kind of talking to himself, not with another persona or being. So there were a lot of schools, and they argued with one another a lot. So that part of it we understand as pretty common in conventional reality. But Shantideva doesn't really want to do that. He tells us that even though he's going to have this argument with this fellow, this dialectic. So it's an argument in the sense of a philosophical argument. He says that in verse 25, we have no intention of refuting the existence of eye awareness, ear awareness, or any other awareness. What needs to be abandoned is the awareness that grasps at existent forms, at truly existent forms. So he's pointing to the difference between the conventional forms, which we all see and know, but as we chant in the Heart Sutra, to remind ourselves, there are also not those forms. And then what particularly strikes me about Shantideva in this, especially in this chapter where he brings it all together is that he uses both his left brain and his right brain. So he writes this amazing guide, which is poetry. It's the intuitive, the creative, and yet he's very respectful of the other side of his brain that draws the conclusions, that connects the dots, that works with the world as we actually perceive it, one thing at a time. Of course, sometimes in our senses, several things come in, but the way, according to neuroscientists, the mind works is it one perception at a time. Otherwise, we'd be some other creatures, apparently. So bringing it to our practice with Dogen, he brings this idea of emptiness forward in many, many fascicles. And he also uses that part of his brain, which is the creative and the intuitive, and in so many beautiful ways, which I'll just say, remind us of a couple of them. He turns that part of him and us, particularly us, he's speaking to his monks and the rest of us who are still listening to and benefiting from his words many centuries later. He turns the language on its head, he says things like this. An ancient Buddha said, mountains are mountains, waters are waters. These words do not mean mountains are mountains, water and are mountains, and waters are waters. They mean mountains are mountains, and waters and are waters. So he uses contradiction. He uses language in ways to like jolt us out of our ordinary mind way of thinking that this is the way things work because we can describe it that way. And then of course, really getting to the heart of this chapter in a way, I think of Shantideva, the Genjo Koan. To follow the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be awakened by all things. To be awakened by all things is to let mind and body drop away. Even the traces of awakening come to an end, and this traceless awakening continues endlessly. So there's a little story I wanted to read you about Shantideva. It's from Stephen Batchelor's translation of Nagarjuna's The Middle Way, which he titles Verses from the Center. And it's about the legend. I don't see Randy here now, but he asked about some more. These are legends, and this is where I remembered where I had read some of these legends. He says, the legend is that after he spoke this first verse, which I read to you of the 10th chapter, after he had this magical Manjushri experience where Manjushri brought down the throne, he disappeared in a poof of cloud. And all the monks were just like, really? Where is he? You know? So he just disappeared. That's the legend. And then what happened to him? So there are more stories about that. He says, having delivered his masterpiece, Shantideva shuns renown and seeks anonymity. And then there's bits of biography that tell us he was a palace guard and that he went to the mountains to be a hermit at one point. Then he lived with a consort in Bengal. And so he disappeared in a way. And this is what other writers who talk about Shantideva pick up on. He disappeared into the world. He didn't want to stay and be famous and known for anything, although people somehow kept his words. I'm not sure how that happened. But he disappeared into the world, which reminds me of the ox herding pictures. How now that we have spent this time meditating with, reflecting on our bodhisattva vows, we go out into the world. We're lay people, so we are in the world already. And there are a couple of versions of the ox herding pictures in one, which is considered an earlier one. There are only six, and the last picture is an Enso. So kind of like Shantideva disappearing into emptiness. But in the 10, the ninth one is the Enso, is this Enso, the emptiness. And the 10th one is the ox herder reappearing in the world, often depicted as a marketplace, and he's carrying a bag and some things. So that's what we'll be disappearing into the world. It said somewhere, going into the world with bliss bestowing hands. I think that's Shantideva's message, taking this out into the world. And the last chapter really makes that very clear. And I wanted to read a couple of things that we didn't read before when we read this morning. And beginning with the verse, one verse we did read. By virtue of my merits, may all beings everywhere, tormented by sufferings of body and mind, find physical comfort and mental joy. May the bodhisattvas fulfill the welfare of the world in the very manner they have intended. And may all living beings receive everything the Buddhas have intended for them. May no one ever experience physical pain, mental anguish, or sickness, and may all be free from all forms of unhappiness. May no one ever be afraid or be belittled. May I always live humbly, sustained by simple food throughout my lives. May I abide in solitude and always find ideal conditions for achieving my spiritual goals. So this has been our form of solitude, being in Sesshin for a week together. And may we return to the world with bliss-bestowing hands. So that's what I brought for today. And I am happy to hear what you have to say.
May I ask a question? I can't hear you. Can you hear me, Carolyn? Okay. So the question is inspired from Dogen's quote, where he said that when a Buddha says that mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers, they are in fact not mountains and not rivers, but they are still mountains and rivers. And so so he's trying to express that contradiction. And when we are studying the Dharma using through Shantideva and through the Buddha, we're always using these words and these forms to express the formless. And so we're always using some kind of pictures or words to understand something which does not have pictures and words. And so once we have understood that, we have understood that the formless does not have any form, and the words will never be able to describe the formless. And then we are studying Shantideva, we are studying Buddha, and we are studying Dogen. They're kind of saying the same thing in all of these different ways. As you said, Shantideva talked about his right brain and left brain, and using creative ways to express these things. So once we have intellectually understood this idea of formlessness and how the intellect can express this idea of formlessness in all these different ways, where do we go from there? I mean, once we have that, like for me, it seems like I hear the same things when I hear Shantideva, when I hear the Buddha, when I hear Dogen, when I hear Alan Watts, when I hear Jiddu Krishnamurti, when I hear a lot of these teachers, they're all saying the same thing. I feel like I'm reading the same thing again and again. How do you go from there? What do you do? You're muted. Okay.
Thank you, Karn. Well, one of my teachers says, if you try to understand it, you're lost. If you try to get it, you don't get it. So it's like where we go is a living with not knowing at that point. We live with, okay, we think we've understood this intellectually, but what is the embodied experience that we have of it? It's a koan. It's a koan. And I quote again, the sixth ancestor, verses on the faith mind, words, the way is beyond words. We just live with the koan. And so there's a way in which just living with that and being at ease with that allows us to somehow have faith that another way will open up for us to understand this. The intellect is at the level of the conventional, but the formless, what can we say about it? Thank you. Kathy.
After Barnes' comments, this feels like a very ordinary mind question. And maybe the answer is the same one that you gave Karn, but early in the Dharma talk, you said we live in the relative world. And if that's the case, what and where is the absolute world? Or is it simply emptiness?
Thank you. Actually, the relative and the absolute coexist. So we live in both worlds.
The other day, Carolyn, you talked about these Buddha tankas, that these fabric arrays with many bodhisattvas laid on them. And on Monday, Paula talked about some of her work in writing that Madeline said she was delving into emotions. And Paula said it's more like excavating. Well, as systems are similar, like, that's why metaphors work so well. Where did the excavations go? And so I want to speak a little bit to that. When you mentioned the Buddhist tankas, of course, I thought of a tanka truck. And a tanka truck full of excavations of emotions, of excavations of the endless wrongdoings of this lifetime. And having dumped many loads of dirt, and they kind of disappears back into with other dirt. And where do these excavations of emotions and remembrances of our shortcomings, when we let them go, where do they go? And I want to speak to the formless as to where it goes. And it comes back out of the formless. And yet it's just so odd that the Buddha tanka with all those Buddhas on that fabric, and just imagining all of the wrongdoings each one of them had to go through in order to awaken or to continue to awaken. It's the formless is rich with wrongdoings. Any comments?
Thank you, Doug. So that's bring in a really other important part of this, that it's all coming and going, it's all disappearing and appearing. And yet our perceptual level, the creatures that we are, cannot apprehend this through the senses. That's why there's so much emphasis on the senses in Buddhism, I think. I loved what you said about the metaphor you used about the dirt and how it all disappears, and thinking of the Buddhas and all the wrongdoings. So one thing that comes to me is the metaphor of like cosmic dust. Where are we going to go? We're all just disappearing back into that cosmic dust and maybe reappearing. And so that's what we have to work with, the metaphors. I also feel like all the wrongdoings that the formless has, and all the blessings and all the right, the formless has everything. The formless has everything. Wow. The stories of the life Buddha, the Jataka tales, where the Buddha was a bodhisattva for, as you point out, many lifetimes before he or she got to be a Buddha. So, and did many simple things in order to get there, helping, moving one ant across the path out of the way. So thank you. That brought up a lot of comment for me, Doug. Thank you very much for bringing that in.
Hi, Karen. I'm sorry to miss the first part of your talk, but Doug's comment just really triggered something that I feel like that energy. I mean, you know, we can transform energy. It doesn't go anywhere. And to use Doug's Tonka truck analogy, it feels like we can develop our efficiency and ability to move the crap and sift it and allow it. And it feels like the work of dealing with our own wrongdoings is transformed into greater compassion. And at least for me, that's my feeling, is that the more I develop this ability to allow, investigate, and nurture, the more I'm able to do that more broadly. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Deborah.
I dipped a little into Suzuki Roshi's Beginner's Mind last night, and I wrote, "Beginner's Mind, a boundless sky, arriving nowhere."
I'd like to say to Doug that what comes to mind for me is that we want to recognize what's in the dump truck. Karn, I love the way you intellectualized so much of Carolyn's talk. And it seems though that, of course, being human, there's so much more. And so much more to life that we feel and we see and we smell. And although there's a lot of warnings not to be carried away with our senses and not to be carried away with desires, still we are humans and we exist. And so these are benefits, and this is part of our life. And so the mountain, there is a mountain, but that's just one word, mountain. But what is a mountain? I mean, it's layers, it's rock formations, layers of life and trees and animals, and it just goes on and on. And so this is just, I think, my way of seeing how we're just part of so much.
I just want to fill in the... Do I want to fill in the excavation, or do I want to excavate it more? I don't know. Balin was, I just want to put the picture for you, Doug, because I think you'd like it. You would have liked to have been there. I was sitting under, leaning against Jeffrey Pine Tree, pretty large Jeffrey Pine Tree, on the east side of the Sierra in the foothills. I think it was in Buttermilk outside Bishop. My mother had died. That was the first summer trip to the mountains after my mother died. She died in the middle of January, and we went there probably in June, July, August. We were in the Sierras, and I was just writing in my journal, and I guess I don't know if it was just a lump of coal, you know, it's just lumps of coal, I think. But I really can't continue the metaphor as well as you did, Doug. but it was just about my mother. That's all there was for me. There was only that. And it led the way, and this was not my intention, but it led the way. I don't know if it was later that, I think it was later that summer, because I was looking over the White Mountains, and I wrote a poem that I still have and I still like, and also looking out over the tablelands, and which is just an incredible sight. It's just, you're looking down and everything looks flat, but then in the right light, you can see these, like, where the river had been before they drained it. It's like excavated and it had worn its way down into the valley, through the valley, the sides of the river. But it was called the tableland because it was just a little above the valley and it looked like a table. So I did eventually write several poems coming out of that. And it wasn't so, I wasn't doing it to cure myself. I was just doing it to, I was also sitting a lot under that tree, you know, zazen under that tree as well. And it was just what happened.
Thank you, Paula.
Kamala. I'm having a little deja vu because I think it was the last day of Rohatsu session where I said almost this, which is that there is this joy in this practice, even though we've been, you know, facing the wall and facing ourselves and listening to the teaching of Shantideva and Dogen, and thank you, Carolyn, for all the people you brought in. I'm touched by Doug's story about excavation because for me that comes up with the rain. It goes, you know, I see it trickling down the streams and rivulets into the ground and then it's gone. And then maybe it comes up in a pool and then it's gone. And I always really feel liberated by that coming and going. The coming and going of everything and the impermanence, which some of the time is really hard to accept and some of the time is really easy to accept. So it is the piece of joy for me as well as loss. And I don't think that all the wrongdoing, for example, can be separated from all the joy and the loss and the joy and the freedom of, I guess, knowing that we need each other and that it's enough.
Thank you, Pamela. Karn.
Would you say a bit about the Bodhisattva journey across multiple lives and what has been said by the Buddha or Dogen or Shantideva? For example, you mentioned that that little by little the Buddha came to his life where he finally attained his complete and perfect enlightenment, that he had been on this journey across multiple lives. And I've seen that mentioned in other places as well. I've seen that mentioned in the Diamond Sutra. And then I've heard that said by other teachers who talk about the dharma and the emptiness and the formlessness in various ways. But could you say a bit about this thing of multiple lives? So does that mean that that the Buddha or others taught that there is an entity that is preserved across multiple lives, and anything that you would like to say about that?
Thank you. That's a question that has concerned people from the earliest Buddhist teachings that are on record. And the Buddha in the early teachings would not address that question. He would not say whether a life form was carried on or not. He said, "This is not what I'm teaching. I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering." So, but other people have said many things, and different traditions in Buddhism look at it in different ways, as is the wonderful multiplicity of life. There are many ways to look at things. But some of the ancient myths, certainly of the tales when the Buddha was a bodhisattva, talk about multiple lifetimes. That's also in historical context of the philosophies that were prevalent in India at the time of the Buddha's life. So there were definitely those philosophies. And Buddha went to many places on his 45-year journey around northern Italy, India, and met with different groups of Jains and various Hindu and other philosophical schools which no longer exist. And they exchanged views, but on that view, when people asked him, he said, "That is speculation and I am not interested in," I'm not quoting here, I'm paraphrasing, "I am not interested in getting involved in that." So that's what I can offer. It's not that other Buddhists, including sometimes Dogen, if I remember well, I tend not to remember those fascicles, but certainly he does allude to, uses multiple lifetimes, mentions them. One could also look at them as metaphorical. We have such a tiny sense of time. Our time scale is just like this is a common trope, a common metaphor, like a fly or something. Looking at the vast timetables that Paula mentioned and that Doug mentioned, excavating deep down, or the rivers flowing through, and Pamela brought in, those are vast timescales. So it helps us to have these metaphors, to maybe use some patience Shantideva also mentions metaphors like this in his chapter on patience. Have some patience to not be needing or wanting to know everything right now. So I hope that addressed some of what you were looking for. Thank you.
I'm quite impressed by how Shantideva is so deeply understanding and appreciative of the role of his enemies or of people who cause trouble, and how that can be can evoke one's own deepest positive response. And yet on the other hand, he hopes and prays that all these people who are suffering and doing terrible things and feeling overwhelmed and so on, he hopes that they will achieve understanding and that they will become happy, and by implication then that they won't be causing trouble to people like him or like any of us. So I like that kind of sort of seemingly contradictory aspects, because our life is so so complex and wonderfully contradictory. So I really appreciate the richness that he brings forth, and for our time, that we can again and again step back and view these things that seem terrible and that we don't like and that we want to change, but that we can see them somewhat from Shantideva's appreciation of the possibilities that those difficulties are granting us for the our development of a clarified mind, or a beautiful mind to respond to these things.
Thank you, Jerome. Tom.
This is not much, but I like the idea that Shantideva and Huineng were contemporaries. Even though they were far apart, they lived in the 8th century. So that's it.
Well, thank you for bringing that in. Yes, it gives that expansive across time and space. Thank you. Well, we could continue on with some kinhin, and then, as Angie always used to say, and more sitting.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.